introduce you to our speaker for this evening, Suzanne N. from Santa Maria.
Big sigh. I'm Suzanne. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Kevin for asking me to speak today. I don't know how many of you were looking forward to Patty O, but I know I was and still am. There was a point I was driving this morning, I thought, you know, I could go to Mission Viejo and pick her up, hold her hostage, and bring her today so that I didn't have to do this. Couple of things. I need somebody to look at their watch and tell me when 45 minutes is, because Kevin was going to make me do the mental math, and I can't. What time is 45 minutes?
25 after.
5 after? 25. Dang it. All right. It is an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to welcome anybody that's new. I hope you hear something that keeps you coming back to the next meeting. I used to do a disclaimer when I got up here that sometimes I can be controversial, and I love the way everybody's laughing, because when I go out of town, nobody knows that, so they just sit and wait for it, you know, through the whole pitch. But I've kind of mellowed over the years, so I don't know that I need to do that. I do know that I share my experience, strength, and hope, you know, and sometimes my experiences may not be your experience. I know it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the utmost respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did use drugs, and I don't call them neat euphemisms like, you know, outside issues or accessories or whatever. You know, I say drugs because they're drugs, you know, and I don't talk about drugs through my whole story. I mean, my main problem was alcohol, and that's why I'm here, because I'm an alcoholic. And you know, if you guys were alcoholics like I'm alcoholics, you would never offer something this small. It's go big or go home, okay? I also noticed the coffee cups are non-alcoholic coffee cups, because they're like this big, and it's like, what am I going to do with that? Right? And somebody asked me if I was nervous this morning, and I'm like, yeah, a little bit, as I drink more coffee. And I thought, oh, good, I'm going to be vibrating by the time I get up there, you know. And that's never good. I came to my first meeting in middle of March, 1989. And I had gotten a DUI in October, and they gave you 6 months to get this little green court card signed. And I had until like April 1st to get it signed. And I think I came in like March 15th and wanted to whip out these six meetings and just get it over with. And I had put it off for so long because I was afraid. And I was afraid that I would come into AA and it wouldn't work for me. And I was afraid that I would come into AA and it would work for me. Right? I hear a couple of chuckles. You get that. I was afraid to continue to drink, but I didn't know what my life would be like if I stopped drinking. And I had never accomplished anything in my entire life that was of any value to me at all. And I was pretty sure this wouldn't work for me, you know, because I was at the jumping off point, you know, that they talk about in the book. It was like I was getting to a point where I was either going to kill myself or get sober. And I didn't know how to get sober, and I didn't know anybody that knew how to get sober. You know? I had never met anybody that was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first meeting was a Sunday night speaker meeting at the 1600 Club. And my mom made me go. And I was 22 years old, and she knew I had this court card, and she was kind of a good little, you know, untreated Al-Anon as well as an alcoholic, and she had found this meeting. And she got me a meeting schedule that night. And she said, Suzanne, we're going to go to a meeting. And my mom was She was a wonderful lady. She was very outgoing and happy, and you know, everybody knew her because she'd go up and she'd go, "Hi there," and she was just so excited about everything, you know, and she just wanted to jump on the bandwagon with Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to go to a meeting and we're going to get sober. And I was like, okay. So I went to this meeting with her, and the first thing I did was I looked around the room. And I tried to figure out where the front and the back of the room was. And at the 1600 Club, you know, you have to, because the steps are on the wall and then there's a podium over there. And I'm thinking, where can I sit where nobody will notice me? By that point, I was broken. I was so broken beyond repair. And the Sunday night speaker meeting was really big. And the two things I remember are the speaker kept talking about drinking and made me thirsty. The whole time, it was like, why does this guy keep talking about this? I'm trying not to drink, and it's all he's talking about. And the other thing I remember is a guy stood up, and it was a birthday meeting. And he said, "I'm Dan, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober I haven't had a drink in 6 years. And I remember looking at my mom and thinking, these people don't drink at all? What am I doing here? You know, what kind of a stupid program is this? I mean, I don't know what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was, but I was pretty sure you could help me figure out how to drink like a lady, you know. That was the middle of March. And by April 6th is my sobriety day, 1989. And from where I was there to where I got to on April 6th, I started relating to what people were talking about in meetings. It's a progressive disease. It gets worse, never better. I had been drinking for 10 years. I told you a little bit about my mom. My mom was an alcoholic, and so was my dad. And they were both great people. But when you're a teenage alcoholic, you know, I started drinking when I was... I used to say I started drinking when I was 12. And then I went a couple of months ago and visited friends that I used to drink with, and they reminded me that we were drinking when we were like six. And I don't know what somebody's got to do to drink when they're like six, you know? You know, living with an alcoholic when you're young, when you're little, and having to take care of that person puts you in survival mode. And I was never okay in my own skin, and I've heard a lot of speakers say that. I was shy. I didn't want to be around people. I was raised as an only child. I do have... two half-brothers and a half-sister, but they were way older. And I was not okay. I was not okay for a long time. And I like to blame my mom for that. That was my deal. You know, if you had to take care of a grown woman when you're 6 years old, you'd drink too, you know. I probably needed a drink when I was born because I can't remember a time that I was okay. And walking around and having... you know, feeling like your skin is peeled all the time, you know, that was something else. So when I was about 12, I started drinking, and I did it to get back at my mom, because, you know, she was this and she was that, and she was an alcoholic, and so I went down to her. Back in the 70s and 80s, they used to have fully stocked bars. I mean, if your parents were anybody, they had a fully stocked bar with any kind of liquor you could come up with, you know. And my mother used to have these big parties and stuff because she was in real estate and she'd have all this stuff. And I'd go down there, and I remember she drank vodka and grapefruit juice. And I couldn't stand grapefruit juice. So I went and I poured a big tumbler of vodka about this big. And mind you, I'm 12. And I chased it with like flat Diet Coke. And I drank about half of it, and I kept chugging it, and I was waiting for the feeling to come, you know. And it wasn't coming. You know, I'd wait like 2 minutes, and it'd be like nothing. So I'd take one more big swig and wait, and nothing. And I don't know when it was, but I woke up the next morning in a cold bathtub. I had one roller skate on that was flung out the side of the bathtub. I was fully clothed in a cold bathtub, and my mother was banging on the door telling me I was late for school. And that was my first drunk. That was my first blackout. And I remember just being sick as a dog, thinking, I'm never going to do this again. Why do people do this? You know, and then you start feeling a little better, and you're like, you know, I'm just going to have to figure out how to do this right, right? So over the next I don't know, a couple of years, I learned how to drink beer instead of vodka. I switched. I would drink wine. I would drink whatever. But I always looked forward to that feeling. You know, the feeling of I'm okay now. You know, I just wanted to be okay, and I wasn't. And alcohol gave me that. It gave me that feeling of, you know, the feeling of perfect peace and ease. It gave me all the promises in the big book. You know, I could look the world in the eye. I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I mean, I got all that from alcohol, you know? Now, I was raised, I went to private Christian schools until I was in eighth grade. And not that my family was religious or any of that. It was they had after-school care. And my mom was a single mom. I lived with her. My dad, you know, visited my dad on the weekends. And it was, I had to wear skirts every day. Notice I'm not in a dress, and I have to tell this story because Lee told me not to. We went to dinner Friday night, and I had agreed to be the speaker, and then it dawned on me, oh my God, they want women to wear dresses. So I looked across the table at Kevin, and I said, I am not wearing a dress. And he looked at me, and he goes, I wasn't even going to ask you. And he looked all nervous, right? But I was sitting across from Quincy, and if anybody heard Quincy last night, she talked about, you know, how, you know, you wear a dress if you get up to speak. And the only time I've ever worn a dress was I wore a dress for my sponsor because I agreed to be a maid of honor because she said she was never going to get married again. And I ended up in a mauve, puffy-sleeved, satin dress. It was god-awful, you know. And I had a knife in my garter just because I was not okay, you know. Yeah, I was the only drunk girl in eighth grade at the Christian school. Try being that, right? Everything about me seemed different. I felt different. My family life was different. You know, I didn't know that other people's moms didn't drink and pass out, you know, while they're busy burning dinner. I had no idea. But when you're surrounded by the nice Christian families and they invite you to their house for dinner and everybody sits around a table and they're all, you know, talking about their day, and nobody's like passing out and, you know, burning dinner, you're like, wow, not everybody lives like this. And all it did was it made me feel different one more time, you know. I got about done with all of that when I went to high school, and I had been to Lutheran school, Christian school, Baptist school. I mean, my mother put me in consistent, you know, all of these things. And I got to the point where I didn't believe in God, because the one thing that they said is, you know, you can pray for what you want and God will take care of it. And I prayed all the time that my mom would stay sober, and she didn't. And I thought, these people lie. I stopped believing in God shortly thereafter, and I started believing in alcohol as my higher power, because it made me okay. It made me feel okay. I would look better. You know, I was pretty hot when I drank. I mean, you can imagine, right? You know, I'm 15 years old. I'm in my skin-tight tank top with no bra on, and I'm hitchhiking down to L.A. to go see The Who. You know, and that was back in the 80s when everybody, you know, you could still hitchhike. So, you know, I spent, I don't know, 3 years doing that kind of stuff. And my mother was drinking, and this is the part of my inventory that I didn't understand, is what's your part in that, Suzanne? Because my first inventory was all about her. You know, I mean, and everybody else, but she was the main character in my first four step, and it was, she drank and she did this, and she drank and she did that, and da-da-da, and what did you get out of that, Suzanne? Well, I'll tell you what, there is nothing better than an alcoholic mother when you're an alcoholic teenager, because she would pass out about 6 o'clock, and I had a party downstairs in the living room, and we had, you know, an open concept house to where her bedroom was right there. I had loud music going. I had all these people in the house. She never woke up once. And I benefited from her alcoholism, you know, because I could do what I want. I could drink grown men under the table. And I could be anybody that you wanted me to be. Because I didn't know who I was, so whoever you were, I could just line right up with you and, oh, you believe that? Yeah, me too, you know? And, you know, you got to go to pretty low places to be a 15-year-old girl and get into bars and drink. So I soon figured out, after hanging out with surfers, because I lived on the beach in Oxnard, and surfers are boring. I'm sorry. Sit on the beach, watch me surf. Now, bikers, on the other hand, they're a lot of fun. So in the hierarchy of alcoholics, bikers are at the top of the food chain, because I walk into a bar with three bikers and I'm 15 years old. They're going to serve me. And they're not going to ask a lot of questions. They're going to tell me, if the cops come, you go out the back door. And I could do that. I consistently put myself in harm's way. I consistently put myself in danger. Because once I take a drink, I don't stop. And once I take a drink, I can't protect myself. And the thing about being an alcoholic during those years, 12 to 18, is I was in a blackout or drunk, and I missed all those parts where you learn about self-esteem and relationships and friendships and how to be a good person and integrity and all of that. I missed that part. I was busy lying under the beer truck. You know, I really was. And when I was about 15, I met a guy named Wayne. And he was 24. And there was only two requirements to be my boyfriend. And one of them is that you have to be over 21, because I need somebody to buy alcohol for me, right? And you need to drink like I do. And he fit the bill, and as an extra added bonus, he had a 57 Triumph. It was candy apple red and chopped. And he had a job. So he was way overqualified to be my boyfriend. So we went to bike runs, and we ripped and roared for a long time. And I tore through a lot of relationships, friendships. My mother was just nuts. I mean, she didn't know what to do with me. She sent me to psychiatrists. I had to go to teenage rap groups. I mean, it was, Suzanne, what's wrong with you? You know. I'm going to take you to a doctor and find out what's wrong with you, she always say to me. You're rude, crude, and vulgar, Susanna. We need to do something with you, you know. And I could go in and I could game the best of them. I mean, she sent me to the Palmer Drug Abuse Program in Camarillo at one point. And back then, there wasn't a lot of drug treatment. And I went in there and I just totally gamed that guy to where he told my mother, you know, I think it's just a phase. I think she's just going through a phase. So when I was about 18, I found myself pregnant. And my mother there was a couple of sayings she had. You know, what's wrong with you and what are you going to do with the rest of your life? That was her big thing. Since I was like five, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I'm like, I don't know, I'm five. And that was always a question in the back of my mind, because my big goal was just graduate from high school. I mean, I'd been kicked out of high school. I went to continuation. I graduated high school. And 2 months after I graduated high school, I found out I was pregnant. And I looked at my mom, and she had found out. She just knew. And I said, she said, are you going to have the baby? And I said, yeah. I said, this is going to be easy. It's kind of like a pet. I remember thinking, how hard could it be? Women have been doing this for years, right? And I said, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. It was like I had a goal, you know? And I thought, this is going to keep me sober, you know? And the thing that I did, the thing that happened with that is that I gave birth to a conscience. That's what I did. And, you know, Wayne was, he was an alcoholic, but he was also a drug addict, and he used to shoot cocaine. And, you know, I had these visions of white picket fences and we're going to live happily ever after as a family and it's going to be great and I've got the bassinet and, you know, we got this little studio and he parked his motorcycle in the living room and, you know, we're going to be a family. And the delusion of that was amazing because we had drug dealers coming in and out of the house. I had people coming and putting guns to my head because he was stealing from people. I mean, he would steal my car, he would take my money, and he'd leave, and I watched him, and I watched the denial, and what I got out of that was, look over there, you're not looking at me, you know, I'm drinking, I'm smoking pot, but I don't use needles, at least I don't use needles, you know, And I can always compare myself to other people. You know, they say that alcoholics are the only people that can lay in the gutter and look down on other people. And I believe that to be true. You know, he eventually died of his addiction when he died a week before my daughter's third birthday. And my life was slowly going downhill because before he passed away, I was tired of his nonsense. He was in and out of hospitals. He had open-heart surgery. He was my problem. Down there was my problem. And my mom said, you know what, I think we'll move you to Santa Maria. Now, I didn't know where Santa Maria was. I didn't care, but I needed to go. Because by that point, I had this little person that I was drinking every day, and my mom was taking care of her, and well, I'd pass out on the couch. The guilt and shame that goes along with being an alcoholic mother, I can't even tell you. My mom moved me up here, and it was going to be a new start for me, you know, because I wasn't going to drink when I was here, because I wasn't around all those people. And that was my geographic. And my dad moved me up here, and about within 20 minutes of his, you know, truck pulling away from dropping off all my furniture, I had met the neighbor in the back who was 21, and I went back there. I had myself a 12-pack, and it was on again. And the thing about it is the geographics where you move, where you don't know anybody, nobody has your back. And I was doing the same things in Santa Maria that I had done down there, except I didn't have big bikers behind me. I was going into bars in town. I was under 21. I was going into bars. I was picking fights with people. I would go up to the biggest biker guy in the bar, the biggest guy in the bar, and I would say, "You are the ugliest woman I've ever seen in my life." And I wondered why I got my butt kicked, right? By this point, my alcoholism had progressed so much that I was coming in and out of blackouts. You know, I related to the speaker last night and the night before, where it was like I never knew when I was going to black out. Never knew. I could be having one beer and all of a sudden I'm in a blackout. You know, the thing that I related to when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous was there's a part in one of the books that says that other people, we judge ourselves by our intentions and other people judge us by our actions. Because I never intended to do the things that I did. Had I not been drinking, I wouldn't have done the things that I did, you know. And the things that were done to me would have never happened. You know, women alcoholics, we take ourselves places and we do things we never would have done. You know, and the shame and the guilt that goes along with that, it's really hard to stay sober because I would tell myself, I'm going to be a good mom. It's going to be okay. I'm not going to drink. You know, I'll have like two beers and I'm going to be a good mom. And I would have those two beers, and then those two beers would have two beers, and then it was off. And to wake up in the morning and think, where's my car, is one thing. But to wake up in the morning and think, where's my kid? There is no feeling like that, you know? And to call people and go, hey, I happened to drop my daughter off there last night. You know, and to wait for the phone to ring and hear my mom go, are you ever going to pick your kid up? And the big sigh of relief. I'm never doing that again. But the guilt and shame that come along with doing that comes back up. Once I start, you know, the hangover, once that starts being okay, then the thoughts come and I have to drink again. I have to drink because of the things I did the night before because I'm so ashamed. Even though I tell myself every day, I'm not going to do this again. I can't do this anymore. Pretty soon I'm drunk again and I'm wondering how that happened. You know, and 4 years that goes on, and the insanity that I feel like I've lost my mind. I feel like, you know, that was another thing that I had, is I thought maybe I wasn't an alcoholic, that I was just screamingly mentally ill, because who does this? You know, I came here and I didn't meet a lot of alcoholics. I met a lot of normal drinkers. You know, unfortunately, I met a lot of normal drinkers and they'd say, hey, you want to go out for a beer? And I'm like, sure. Right? We go to the bar, we have a beer, and they're like, okay, well, I'm going to go now. Wait, what? I will hold you hostage. We are going to rip and roar. I am not going to leave until, you know, the cops come. I mean, this is how I drank. You know, and they're like, no, I don't think so, you know. So there again, I felt different. When I came in on that court card and I left, I had to go drink again because I because I had to. And within, between March and, it was like, after I left that meeting, I thought, I'll get sober after St. Patrick's Day, which was the 17th of March. St. Patrick's Day, I went to a bar. I threatened a barmaid. I almost got raped. I ended up in jail. And I walked back to the bar, and I pulled a knife on the barmaid. And I came over the bar at her with a knife. I don't remember that part. What I remember is I came down off the bar. There was a lady behind me, and I still don't know who it was, and she put her hand on my shoulder. And she had been in the bar the night before, and she had said, "Suzanne, haven't you been through enough?" And for some reason, I listened, and I went home, and I woke up the next morning, and I knew my mom had my kid. And I sat on the floor and I thought, I can't do this anymore. And I took out a knife because that's all I had, because I used to carry a knife around a lot and threaten people. Never carried a gun because I knew bad things were going to happen if I had a gun. And I thought, I'm just going to stab myself to death. And for some reason, this God I didn't believe in, all of a sudden I said, God, help me. And I put the knife down and it was like being propelled by a force. And I got up off the floor. And I went into the kitchen and I opened the junk drawer and there was the meeting schedule for Alcoholics Anonymous that my mother had given me. And I looked and there was a Sunday 11 o'clock meeting. And I called my mom and I said, I need to go to a meeting. And I went to the meeting and I sat across from this lady who was all nice and everybody looked good and smelled good. And I had a different attitude when I walked in there because I was done. I was broken. I looked like crap. I had been up for about 3 days. And I just sat there slumped over. And I listened to you. I listened when you said honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I listened when you told me that we do this a day at a time. And I wasn't sure I could do it, but there was a little bit of hope. And I hadn't had hope in I don't know how long. And after that meeting, you know, I'm hearing the newcomer's the most important person in the room. And I went and I sat out on the bench of the 1600 Club after the meeting, and everybody walked by, and a couple people introduced themselves, but they kept walking. And this old man, Monty, came up to me, and he had about 2 years, and he talked to me, and he said, "Susanna, you think you can stay sober until 7 o'clock tonight at the speaker meeting?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Can you stay sober for another hour?" I said, "Maybe." He said, "I want to see you at this meeting tonight. I want to see you at the speaker meeting." And where I came from is I've been kicked out of every bar in this town. I realized last night that I've never gone to the American Legion, and that might be the one place I was never kicked out of in this town. And to be invited back somewhere was huge for me. And for him to remember my name when I came back later that night was huge for me. And I sat in that room and I listened to the speaker, and her name was Mary G, and she told my story. And she came up to me after the meeting and hugged me, and nobody had hugged me without grabbing me in years. And when she hugged me, all I could do was stand there like this because I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't feel worthy. And I would sit in meetings and I would feel like everybody was judging me. And everybody was, you know, because, I mean, when you're sitting in a meeting and you've got your too tight tank top on with no bra and your beer belly hanging out, your old jeans and your, you know, boots, and I just sat there and I didn't want you to talk to me and I didn't want you to look at me and I wanted to fade into the corner. I really did. And there was people that loved me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would tell me, "We're going to love you until you love yourself." And they did. And they did. And, you know, those people are the only reason that I'm here today, is because I was made to feel welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't believe in God. And I didn't think I could do this program, but I believe that you believed. And my first sponsor told me, "I don't care what you believe. Every morning I want you to wake up and I want you to pray to this God." And I used to wake up in the morning and I'd go, "Okay, big spook, if you're out there, keep me sober today." And I thought, this is dumb. And I'd tell her, "This is dumb. I don't believe in God." And she'd say, "I don't care what you believe. You do it anyway. It works just the same, whether you believe it or not." And she taught me how to pray, and she taught me how to ask for things that I needed, like, God, remove the fear, because I was so afraid. I mean, I had a three-year-old daughter. All of a sudden, I'm coming to. I'm a crappy mom. I don't have a job. I'm unemployable. And I just didn't think I could do this because I'd never accomplished anything in my life. And they would tell me, it's a minute at a time, it's a day at a time, you don't take the first drink. You know? And I believed them. You know, work the steps, Suzanne, and I'd start to work the steps, and I did it. You know, I don't know. I think back and I go between, I totally believed you and thought you were awe-inspiring and you guys were saints, and oh my God. And then I'd go, you guys are so full of crap. And I can't believe a word you say, and this stuff is stupid, and you're lame, and I don't want to do this. So when my sponsor would ask me to do something, I would do it just to prove her wrong. And guess what? It worked, you know? And I would lay in bed at night, and the thing that was going to take me out was all the secrets that I had and all the shameful things that I had done. And I could be okay during the day because I knew I was safe as long as I went to the meeting an hour before and sat there and talked to the old men. And then I stayed for the meeting for an hour. And then afterwards, I would stay for an hour. And then we would go to coffee until like 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I could be safe as long as I was in that time frame. But when there wasn't a meeting, this would go. And when I would go home at night and I would lay down and I'd go to sleep, those tapes would play, all the shameful things I'd done, all the things that were done to me, all the horrible things that happened, what a bad mom I was. That would just play in my head over and over and over again. And then one night I laid there and I thought, I can't do this anymore. God, I can't. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that I laid there and I pictured myself laying in the palm of God's hand and I could sleep. So every night I would lay in bed, and when the tapes would start and the shame would come, I would picture myself curled up laying in God's hand, because my sponsor told me, your God can be anybody you need him to be. And I needed a big God because I had some big problems and I had a lot of guilt and shame. And I worked the steps and I did it to the best of my ability. You know, and I continue to try to do that today. The first year of my sobriety, I wanted to drink every day, just about every day. And then it would be every other day, and then it would be every 3 days and every 4 days. And my sponsor pointed out to me, the miracles are starting to happen for you. And by the time I had a year, I said, Mary, I still want to drink. And she said, have you prayed for the obsession to be removed? Because Mary told me I could pray for anything I wanted, but it had never occurred to me to pray for the obsession to be removed. And I did that, and it was. And my first inventory was the best I could do, but it was complete crap, and it was blaming you. And I rewrote it, and I scratched out the parts that made me look bad. And, I mean, I did like 3 drafts of my first 4-step because I didn't want to look bad. And it was enough. You know, I used alcohol to push all that stuff down and all those feelings down. And when you remove the alcohol, everything comes up, and it comes to about here. And for me, my character defect is anger. And I will push you away. And I would go to Mary's house and I'd pace and I'd go on and on and on. And I would get it out a little bit at a time. You know, I've had a lot of experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked the steps, and all of a sudden after about 2 years, people are telling me, Suzanne, you're doing so good. You are doing so good. God, you've grown. I'm like busy doing this. Like, yes, I have. I haven't told anybody to F off in a meeting in like a year, right? I'm not picking fights in the parking lot. I'm doing really good. You know, and I continue to work with other people, and I was of service because I was taught that you stay of service, you will stay sober. You know, but after a while, you start thinking, is this all there is? You know, and I was still going to meetings, but pretty soon I was taking your inventory and not mine. And, you know, and I stopped doing the things that I was doing. And it's like a Jenga thing, you know. You pull out one block like, nah, I don't want to be of service. I don't want to go to that meeting. I don't want to read how it works. I'm not saying the Lord's Prayer anymore. And then that one thing comes up, and pretty soon all your blocks fall down. Well, my blocks fell down in right about 6 years of sobriety. And luckily I kept going to meetings. And there was people in Alcoholics Anonymous that reached out to me and And I said, I don't know what to do. I'm losing my mind. You know, I'm either going to drink or kill myself, and I'm sober, and I didn't get sober to feel like this. And they said, well, how about we go to McDonald's and do a third-step prayer in the parking lot on a Sunday morning in front of God and everybody? And then you can start your inventory. So I did that because pain will make me willing to do anything. I am like trapped I feel trapped, and it's like I will do anything to get out of pain. And hopefully it's something that's productive and that keeps me in recovery. Because I can go either way, and I'll tell you, it doesn't matter how much time you have, you can switch addictions. I'm having uncomfortable feelings. I don't like to feel like that. Well, I'm going to go shopping. I'm going to get in a new relationship. I'm going to have sex with anybody I can find. I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to walk away because I'm busy, you know, and I'm tired. Currently, you know, lately I've been in a close, intimate, personal relationship with Netflix. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous and the thing about, you know, slowly pulling all your blocks out one at a time is that you don't even notice. You don't even notice that you're stepping back, that you're walking away. I did it at 6 years, you know. It takes me less time to realize that now. You know, pretty soon, and the book says that we cut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And the thing that I know for me and that I can spot in other people is when my old behaviors come back, when I start getting angry, when I start getting resentful, that's when I know I'm stepping away from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I was told by my first sponsor that you're either walking towards your recovery or you're walking toward a drink, depending on what you do in that day, and you better be going to meetings and doing this stuff because everything you do of service, of meetings, sponsoring people, that's insurance in the bank that you're not gonna relapse. Because it doesn't matter how much time you got. I could go out tomorrow. I could be up here sounding, oh, great and spiritual and whatever, and then tomorrow lose my mind because I'm not doing anything. You know, I've learned to take the actions and then the feelings follow. You know, I would like to sit around and watch Netflix and wait for me to feel like going to a meeting. Really? Don't we all want to feel like it? I mean, how many times have we said, I don't feel like it, you know? Oh, and I love when my sponsees tell me, oh, I don't feel like it. Well, how do you feel about getting loaded? How do you feel about that? You know, I don't care how you feel, what you think, it's what you do that changes your feelings to where I get grateful one more time because I suit up and I show up and I do things like this. Even when I don't want to, because the thing that I didn't tell you is I told Kevin no. No, I gotta work, and I'm supposed to be at work right now, right? But then, of course, he calls Lee, right? And when Lee calls you and tells you, Suzanne, you've told me you're kind of slow on Sundays. You could ask your supervisor if you could take an hour and a half off. That sticks in your head. So I texted Kevin the next morning, I'll do it. Because I'm willing to suit up and show up for my recovery today. You know, and I suit up and show up and I tell the truth even when it makes me look bad and even when I don't want to. You know, and if the only message that I carry today is that you suit up and you show up and you do the next indicated thing and you be honest, that's what we do, you know, because I don't ever want to go back to being a newcomer again. My first sponsor would tell me, Suzanne, you don't need to go out. You don't need to go out and drink again. Watch these people. They will do it for you. I've watched more people go out and drink and die. I've watched more people go out and get hooked on pills and die. I've watched more people go and ruin their lives. People that had recovery, that had time at one point. My first sponsor went and drank at 6 years. She's never come back to the rooms again. She also told me, you know what? Sometimes, Suzanne, you're the only big book anybody will ever see. You know, and sometimes I'm a good example of that, and other times I'm the blank page in front of the book. You know, I don't know how much more time I've got. What'd you guys tell me? I got 5 minutes. Dang. I could live my whole life and never give back everything that's been given to me in Alcoholics Anonymous.
I have found a way of life like I would never have imagined. And I don't know, a couple of months ago it occurred to me, you know, I was thinking back in my newcomer head. You know, I used to look around at the rooms and I'd think, these are some nice people. They have good jobs, they smell good, they have things that I want. And I would incorporate their character into mine because I didn't know who I was. I was kind of empty when I got here and I had no character. All of it was bad. So I would take the honesty of this lady and all of these attributes that I wanted, and I would incorporate them into myself. And there have been times in my recovery that you'll hear me say in meetings, I have my own approval today. And when I have my own approval, it's because I'm working the program. I'm focusing on me. I'm giving you a break. I'm being kind. I'm reaching out my hand. I'm being of service. You know, and then I start playing Jenga again, and and one by one, those things go away. But then something will happen that I'm reminded one more time. Pick up the book. Reach out to people. Be kind. You know, because I remember what it was like for people to be kind to me when I walked in the rooms. For people to remember my name. Hey, Suzanne, how you doing? And I'm thinking, I didn't even know who she knew who I was. You know, so it's important for me to continue to do that and be there for the next alcoholic who suffers. And sometimes that alcoholic is not a newcomer. Sometimes it's somebody who has time that's going through rough things, that's going through that period between like 5 and 7 to where you feel like, is this all there is? And I'm losing my mind. And you only see these people at like one meeting a week, maybe. You know, I could sit up here and talk all day and still not tell you all the gifts I've been given, and I hope I've expressed some of those. I have a God of my understanding today. That when I can't do it one more time, I pick myself up and I keep going, you know. I have a host of friends. I didn't want any of that when I got here. I wanted you to leave me alone. I would have been okay with that. I've made amends to the people that I hurt. I clear away the wreckage of my past, and I continue to do that because at some point I was not okay in this program, and I remember thinking, why isn't there a chapter to the old timer when you're having a hard time, and what do you do now? You know? And then it dawned on me, oh, that's the first 164 pages, Suzanne. It works. It's not just for newcomers anymore. So if you're having a difficult time, it gets better. You take the actions, and then the feelings follow. Thank you for letting me share.
Suzanne, another hand.